The following program is underwritten in part by Organic Valley Family of Farms, celebrating 20 years, organic and farmer-owned since 1988. Meet your local farmers at organicvalley.coop.
Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
We're all being essentially assaulted by these corporations who have rights under the Constitution to come into our communities and take advantage of us. We're realizing the system is set up for us to fail and for corporations to win. And so when we look at ways to challenge that, new, innovative ways, really outside the box, then we're starting to come up with solutions.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We stand at the threshold of a historic opportunity in the human experiment to reimagine how to live on Earth and with each other in a way that honors the web of life. It's a revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart. As the basic life support systems of planet Earth plunge into dangerous decline, in this series, Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, we celebrate social and scientific innovators with breakthrough solutions guided by how nature does it. The Bioneers, combining social innovation, leading-edge science, and indigenous and traditional knowledge, creating a future environment of hope. Mining companies used to use canaries in coal mines to detect poison gases. If the canary sickened or died, you got out fast. The problem now is that they're blowing up the whole mountain, canaries and all. In today's vastly interconnected world, we're all canaries. Maybe in the past we could avoid the ravages of local destruction far away from our place. Maybe we could turn a deaf ear to the cries of local folks, usually low-income communities or communities of color. But like the environment itself, environmental justice does not recognize human-made boundaries on a map. So the question becomes, can we work with each other in the common recognition that we're all canaries and it's time to close the coal mines? In this half hour, we'll hear from two indigenous environmental health warriors, Clayton Thomas Mueller and Shauna Larson, and from North Carolina, Mary Ann Hitt, who is helping lead the battle against mountaintop removal by King Coal's corporate giants. They're all part of a fresh generation of defenders of human rights and the rights of nature, arrayed against the next wave of colonialism, the ravenous fossil fuel energy machine. Join us for the next half hour as we explore justice or just us, environmental justice as a universal human right. I'm Neil Harvey. Welcome to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Many of you have probably heard about environmental justice, but for those of you that haven't, environmental justice in the most simplistic way means that we all, you know, regardless of race, creed, culture, religion, gender, have the right to clean air, clean water, and clean earth.
For nearly two decades, Clayton Thomas Mueller has been on the front lines resisting industrial society's assault on the lands of indigenous peoples. As a member of the Indigenous Environmental Network, he's defended the rights of grassroots indigenous communities across Canada, Alaska, and the lower 48 states. He's worked to guard their environmental health against destructive energy policies, voracious resource extraction, and toxic dumping. A member of the Cree Nation from Pukatawagon in northern Manitoba, he is currently the Indigenous Tar Sands campaign organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. His international work for environmental justice began at home. Clayton Thomas Mueller spoke at a recent Bioneers conference.
I come from the Cree Nation in northern Canada, and as a young man growing up there, you know, I had a lot of opportunities, a lot of privilege to be out in the bush and to be doing wonderful things with my cousins. There's about 108 of us, I believe, at the last count. To be out doing really beautiful things, to connect with our sacred Mother Earth, things like harvesting raspberries and blueberries and cranberries, things like walking with my great-grandfather along the trap line and collecting the rabbits that we would eat, you know, and going and hunting wild chicken. You know, one of the coolest things that I remember is we had this beautiful beach, and it was really quite neat, eh? Because there was a cliff. You walk down from our cabin, and over here, you've got blueberries in the field along with a bunch of wild flowers. I remember we'd go wading out into the water, and we'd walk out so far. We'd look back, and we'd see our parents on the shoreline, and they would get smaller and smaller. And we'd just be so amazed because it would never get deep. And the bottom of that lake was this beautiful white clay, and we used to fling it at each other. Yeah. It was only until, you know, I guess like in my teenage years that I came to the understanding that that lake was not actually a lake, that it was part of a vast floodplain that had been created through the damming of the Churchill River, otherwise known as the Massinipi, which is Great River in my language, by huge hydroelectric corporations for the purposes of providing cheap electricity to the urban centers in southern Canada. And that actually what we were swimming in was highly contaminated water. Because you see, when you submerge vast tracts of the boreal forest underneath water to create reservoirs for these huge power stations, you know, the natural thing that happens is they release mercury, you know? And so it was interesting. At that point in my life, I began to kind of understand that there was something horribly wrong. You know, I wondered in my young, pitiful mind, like the comprehension capacity I had at that young age, how something so vast could happen, and who said that that was okay? And I knew that I needed to go on a journey to find the ability to articulate this wrong feeling that I had when I came to that understanding. And so I began a journey, you know, to work for our people, to try and find justice. And that brought me to a lot of different places within the movement of our Indigenous people's struggle for sovereignty and self-determination.
And as Indigenous peoples, we have a sacred responsibility that we understand through our creation stories as caretakers of Mother Earth and caretakers of the sacred fires of our traditions. Also have a responsibility to speak and advocate on behalf of those that cannot speak for themselves. And that is the four-legged, the winged ones, the ones that swim, the ones that crawl under the earth, and our plant relatives. And so in that context, for 17 years, the Indigenous Environmental Network has been working on the front lines, you know, challenging corporate power, challenging racist government policies that have been disproportionately targeting our communities to become toxic waste dumps, to become sacrifice zones, so that people living in our unsustainable cities here in the United States and in Canada could continue to live their lives as business as usual, using our communities and effectively turning them into not just dump sites, but now into energy batteries. And this neocolonial type of colonization that is occurring is happening through the road of destruction that is associated with the energy infrastructure that this country utilizes so that we can all cook our food and turn on lights and drive to 7-Eleven and all of that.
The work of Clayton Thomas Mueller's generation carries on a long legacy of resistance. Over the centuries, European colonialists violently took life and land for their own ends. Subsequently, the expanding American empire implemented the doctrine of manifest destiny with waves of settlers and vast thefts of native lands. Even the reservations negotiated by legal treaties soon found themselves under siege when valuable energy reserves were discovered on those supposedly sovereign lands. During the 20th century, insatiable energy demands and high-tech infrastructures intensified the plunder, depleting and harming ever more of the land and its inhabitants. Harming ever more of the land and its people is very personal for Clayton Thomas Mueller. The new environmental justice movement is rejecting the old strategy of colonialism, divide and conquer. So the next wave says, to paraphrase Martin Luther King, justice does not mean just us. It has changed the rallying cry from "not in my backyard" to "not in anyone's backyard."
We're launching our Road of Destruction campaign and linking up all of the areas from the North Slope of Alaska all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico to demonstrate this colonization, to try and promote awareness so that when people in cities are coming up with solutions for urban centers, that they also understand how complex this really is and how interconnected things really are, and so that solutions that come out don't just benefit one segment of the population and sacrifice another. Okay? A lot of you have heard probably about exciting initiatives like in LA, where they got a lot of the dirty diesel buses onto compressed natural gas, which is a good thing for inner city communities of color. You know, and it's done wonders for the pollution and the asthma rates. However, I'm standing here to tell you there's absolutely no such thing as clean natural gas extraction. It's destructive, it destroys lives, and it destroys ecosystems. And there's no clean way to do it, regardless of what corporations say. And the same thing about clean coal. Everybody's heard the hype about clean coal and, you know, injecting CO2 back into the earth. We're going to capture it. Well, first of all, the scrubbers that they develop don't catch the mercury, okay? And the mercury is a neurotoxin and it's naturally occurring. And that stuff spews all over the communities that live beside these big coal burners. And it contaminates our water sources and it contaminates specifically our food sources. And secondly, there's no such thing as clean coal strip mining. There's absolutely no such thing as clean coal strip mining. Like, there's just no way to, you know, whether it's liquid natural gas or coal bed methane, you know, or mega pipelines or oil refineries or power plants. There are economic, social, spiritual consequences that are displaced on the backs of indigenous peoples and communities of color. And this is capitalism, ladies and gentlemen. Original instructions, you know, as indigenous peoples, we've never forgot. And even though our people are in peril and we're in crisis, we still know how to have a good laugh. We get up every day and we take care of our children. We still eat our fish. We harvest our wild rice. We harvest our medicines. We practice our ceremonies and we have not forgotten.
Clayton Thomas Mueller. As modern science increasingly validates ancient empirical indigenous knowledge, Native peoples are inviting us all to remember that we are all indigenous to planet Earth and the local place we live. More when we return. This is Justice or Just Us, environmental justice as a universal human right. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. Globalization usually refers to spurring and connecting economic activity across the world. Its consequences may start locally, but they often quickly become global, traveling far beyond economics into the very circulatory systems of the natural world, which means that responsibility to others can no longer stay local. Human rights are inherently dependent on the health of our ecosystems. Do we all have the right to a healthy environment? Is it a question of justice or just us?
Most of the work that I've done at Alaska Community Action on Toxics is based around persistent organic pollutants, or POPs.
Shauna Larson of Supiak and Atna Athabascan ancestry is an environmental health heroine in Alaska. As a staffer at the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, where she directs the Environmental Justice Program, Shauna has organized some of the most effective pro-health campaigns in the state, including one to safely dispose of medical waste in hospitals and clinics. But Shauna has also been a standard bearer in international struggles, helping secure passage of a UN treaty to eliminate persistent organic pollutants, a class of 12 of the most deadly chemicals worldwide. persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, bioaccumulate up through the food web to horrifying concentrations in higher animals, like us. As a result, Alaska Native communities that rely on traditional hunting and fishing are particularly hard hit. Again, Shauna Larson.
We see a lot of different issues that are based around the contaminant exposure, and it's certainly not just in the tribal base. For tribes, it's a little different because the average household income is about $10,000 per year, and in some of our rural villages, a gallon of milk is $11. And so when things are that disproportionate, we absolutely, not just for cultural survival, but we absolutely have to supplement our household income with our traditional foods and our traditional way of life. And so we are consuming much higher rates of these traditional animals and we're seeing things in them, like when you're cutting the animals open, we're seeing pus sacs and tumors, and certainly we're seeing lesions and things on our fish and other animals that we didn't used to see before. So what we're seeing is not only are we suffering from low birth weight babies, birth defects, diabetes, obesity problems, very high rates of cancer, and now we're beginning to realize that the cancer is certainly not limited to human beings, but also into the other species, our relatives, you know, the ones who crawl, the ones who fly, the ones who swim. And we're very concerned about that. It's a very big issue for us. And I think one of the things that's always good to remember is that certainly these contaminants are not limited just to indigenous peoples or to Alaska, because these are the same contaminants that you find in milk and peanut butter and cheese and eggs and in the local grocery store. So that's why really the globe came together under the United Nations Treaty of the Stockholm Convention, or the POPs Treaty, to try to put a ban on those contaminants specifically. From a tribal standpoint, we have a different legal relationship with the federal government, a trust relationship, a legal relationship, and we're sovereign nations. That's not to say that we're not suffering from the same problems as just regular everyday American communities. And I think that's the tool that Democracy School provides, because it's a way for people to deal with that, but it's also builds a bridge between communities that haven't necessarily been able to find ways to be connected. So how would a small village in very far north Alaska, who is being impacted by these persistent organic pollutants, how would they find commonality with a rural farming community in South Pennsylvania? How would they find a commonality? Well, certainly they don't have the same ethnic background. Certainly they don't speak the same language. They don't really have the same culture. But the thing that we have in common is that we're realizing the system is set up for us to fail and for corporations to win. And so when we look at ways to challenge that, new innovative ways, really outside the box, then we're starting to come up with solutions.
It's a small world, indeed. What goes around comes around, and it's happening faster and faster. But if what's damaging to one is damaging to all, could it also be that what's good for one is good for all? Changemakers from across many different issues and around the world are starting to affirm the same rights against the same forces, with similar lessons to swap. That's the general idea behind the Democracy Schools, a nationwide series of weekend workshops for communities that have one thing in common: they're facing harm from corporations. Shauna Larson is a trainer for the Democracy School in Alaska, founded by pathfinding democracy activists Richard Grossman and Thomas Lindsay. The schools drive home the point that the immediate conflict may mask a larger question of power. What do we want for our community, and who gets to decide?
We've been trying to integrate that into the work we're doing into Alaska. This is not the traditional organizing model that we've used in the past, and it's really based on rights-based, place-based campaigning versus issue-based campaigning. I think the exciting thing about this is it really talks about how we've all been colonized, and it's interesting to see how this bridges a gap, which is something new and something I haven't seen before, really bridges a gap between indigenous communities, minority communities, and non-indigenous and non-minority communities. And so to show us that we all have something very much in common, we're all colonized and we're all oppressed. It's just in different ways and at different levels. We're all being essentially assaulted by these corporations who have rights under the Constitution to come into our communities and take advantage of us, whether we're from a small rural native village, a reservation, a small community, a fence line community, or we're just a regular everyday American community that's being essentially assaulted by corporate America.
Shauna Larson. The assault she describes would be familiar to any number of community leaders, such as Marianne Hitt. As the executive director for Appalachian Voices, she has helped lead a campaign against mountaintop removal. Marianne Hitt spoke with us at a recent Bioneers conference.
When you think of coal mining, I think most people think of somebody going under the ground and digging out the coal and bringing it out. And in mountaintop removal, what they do instead is instead of taking the coal out of the mountain, they just take the whole mountain off of the coal. And the way they do that is by drilling holes and filling them with explosives and just blowing up the whole mountain. And the coal is in the mountain like layers in a cake. And so they blow up one layer of rock and they push it off into the valley. And then they bury the streams. I mean, they've buried over 1,000 miles of streams in Appalachia. And they've flattened over 1 million acres of mountains. And these are mountains that people used to look out at from their front porch and people used to walk on and pick medicinal plants from and that used to harbor lots of wildlife, and they're gone.
More than 470 such decapitations already ravage the Appalachians, according to one review of Google Earth images visible on the web. A whole generation of children cannot go to the mountaintop. Even worse, they're afraid it will come tumbling down on top of them.
One woman we work with a lot, her kids will, when it rains, they'll sleep in their clothes because they're afraid of a flood coming and they think that they could escape faster. You know, so these little kids are just totally terrified every time it rains. There was a little boy in Virginia who was sleeping in his bed and he was 4 years old, and there was a mountaintop removal operation above him, and they were working on the road at night without proper lights and without a permit. And they loosened this huge boulder, and it rolled down the mountain into the side of the house and killed him in his bed. And he was 4. You know, and I think one of the saddest things about mountaintop removal is that, you know, coal mining is dangerous. And the people who mine coal are very brave. And they deserve the most respect that anyone could ever give a fellow human being. And they also know when they go under the ground that they're taking a risk. But these communities never have signed up for that. And these little kids and all these people, they've never signed up to take on that risk. And suddenly it's just being imposed on them. And it's happening all over Appalachia.
It's extermination without representation. More than 400 mountains shattered, plundered, abandoned. Drinking water fouled, wildlife made homeless. A rich living local culture blasted off the face of the earth. Children terrified to go to sleep in their beds. Massive carbon emissions causing yet worse global warming for future generations. For what? So we can flip on our light switches? Can't we figure out a better way to do that? Of course we can, and many are doing just that. Marianne Hitt points out that the alternative has been there all along, a way to keep people healthy, a culture rooted in its sacred place, a country weaned off fossil fuels.
We could have an economy in Appalachia that's based on restoration and renewable energy, instead of one that's based on resource extraction and shipping out our wealth to other parts of the world. And that's a long way off, but it's, on the other hand, it may be at hand. You know, I mean, this world is confronting some very serious challenges with regards to climate change in particular. And if we were really going to deal with it realistically, we wouldn't be getting ready to build 100 new coal fire plants, and we wouldn't be blowing up mountains for coal. So I think on one hand, it may seem that future may seem a long way off. On the other hand, it may become inevitable. You know, it just may be that the old way of doing business is no longer really possible. And I think in Appalachia, there's so much native local wisdom about the land. I mean, the culture in Appalachia is already doing what I think a lot of people sort of hope to do or aspire to all around the country, which is consuming less, using less electricity, living close to the land, taking care of the natural resources, getting medicinal plants off the land, growing your own food. People in Appalachia have been doing that forever, canning, you know, making their own music. It's a very, very grounded, rooted culture. It's very distinctive. And I think that given the chance and given some of this big energy interest kind of getting out of the way, we could actually have a pretty, and there's a lot of rain, there's a lot of water, there's a lot of biodiversity, there's a lot of wildlife. You know, it can sustain people. And it has for, you know, thousands of years.
Saving the land that supports the people as part of a healthy web of life. Clayton Thomas Mueller, Shauna Larson, Marianne Hitt. From Alaska to Appalachia, these courageous defenders of life, land, and local culture are working on local fronts against local environmental injustices. Their work preserves a broader common inheritance, the cultural landscapes that sustain us all, generation after generation. They're showing that justice cannot mean just us. Justice or just us, environmental justice as a universal human right. Free downloads of this program are available on the radio pages at bioneers.org. Resources related to this show and the entire Bioneers Radio series can also be found at bioneers.org or by calling 877-246-6337. That's 1-877-BIONEER. Visit bioneers.org to become a member, make a donation, learn about the annual Bioneers Conference, or join our thriving online community. Choose from articles, blogs, event calendars, books, podcasts, CDs, and DVDs at bioneers.org or by calling 1-877-BIONEER. The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, is a production of Collective Heritage Institute. Executive producer, Kenny Ossabell. Written by Kenny Ossabell. Senior producer, Neil Harvey. Managing producer, Stephanie Welch. Production assistants, Marita Prandoni. Distribution is by WFMT Radio Network. Original recordings provided by Reference Media Group. Interview recording engineer, Jeff Westman. Our theme music is taken from the album Journey Between by Baka Beyond and used by permission of Hannibal Records, a Rykodisc label. Additional music was made available by Silver Wave Records at silverwave.com. For more music information, please visit bioneers.org. The opinions expressed in the Bioneers Revolution from the Heart of Nature radio series are those of the presenters and are not necessarily those of Collective Heritage Institute, the underwriters, or this radio station. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. I invite you to join the Bioneers in improving the environment by changing the world. This is program number 0408.
This program is underwritten in part by Organic Valley Family of Farms, celebrating 20 years organic and farmer-owned since 1988. Meet your local farmers at organicvalley.coop.